the next appeal before the court is Mark Brockley and Denise Brockley versus Merrill Ellis et al. On behalf of the appellants, we have John Dill, who will be arguing on behalf of the appellees. Richard Plummer will be appearing on behalf and arguing on behalf of Mr. Tricano and the trustee. And Cesar Juarez will be arguing on behalf of the appellees, Hickox. I understand, Mr. Plummer, you've got 4 minutes on your argument, and Mr. Juarez, you have 11 minutes. Okay. So with that, then, Mr. Dill, you may proceed with your initial argument.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, ladies and gentlemen of the gallery. My name is John Dill. I'm here today representing the appellants in this matter, the Brockleys. And this case is fundamentally about judgment holders trying to enforce a judgment against an LLC member, the only way authorized in South Dakota, by something called a charging order. And this case is also about how the LLC members, which at the time would be Mr. Tricano and Mr. Griffin, one of the defendants in the original lawsuit, how they schemed to ensure that the appellants couldn't uphold that judgment or enforce it. So to go back quickly, the syllabus pretty much sets out a good factual background. In 2011, an LLC was formed. It's now called Hickox. It was formed by three partners, three people, one of whom left shortly thereafter, leaving Clarence, Nick Griffin, and Mr. Tricano as the remaining members of the LLC. Both of them having a 50% interest. The lawsuit that was originally brought didn't have anything to do with the LLC. It had to do with Mr. Griffin and two other partners in an LLC he formed. In 2015, a couple of things happened. On March 12th of 2015, a summary judgment motion was filed by the plaintiffs, the Brockleys, the appellants here. Two things happened on March 30th. Summary judgment hearing was held, and an assignment of interest was entered, agreed to by Tricano's, wherein Mr. Griffin and his wife Kimberly purported to assign his interest to himself and his spouse as tenants by the entireties pursuant to Florida law.
And that happened before the charging order?
That happened before the charging order, yes.
And before any judgment, obviously, because they're just arguing summary judgment at this point.
That's correct. In fact, the judgment itself was entered 2 weeks afterwards.
So are you arguing that the assignment, because it occurred while a lawsuit was pending, was some sort of violation of a non-existent charging order?
The position is the assignment as tenancy by the entireties doesn't exist because South Dakota doesn't recognize tenancy by the entireties in South Dakota. In 1973,
so
Shimke versus...
Let me follow up with that, Mr. Dillon. If tenancy by the entirety doesn't exist in South Dakota, how did they own, at the time of Mr. Griffith's death, how did they own that interest?
Well, that's a good question. My position is they didn't own it. So if... following me for a second, if tenancy by the entireties doesn't exist in South Dakota, there has to be some sort of ownership interest. And in our brief, I kind of took us through a rabbit hole, what kinds of interests could be owned. But ultimately, it comes down to this. One of the things that's required for transferring an interest in a gaming LLC, and it's important to remember, Hickox was a casino. Hickox is a gaming institution. One of the rules, which was embodied in their operating agreement, says there's no transfers without getting permission from the South Dakota Commission on Gaming. They didn't try to do that. The record shows nobody tried to obtain any kind of permission for a transfer of interest. Consequently, that interest should not have transferred. Even if we ignore the issue of tenancy by the entireties, which I don't think we can because both Hickox and Tricano are trying to convince the court that you can actually create something that South Dakota law specifically says you can't have here.
But would you have standing to enforce the operating agreement, or some regulatory or statutory authority that says you have to have this approval. Is your client the right party to enforce a restriction or a requirement like that?
Well, we're not here to enforce it. We're just here to state that because it wasn't followed, that transfer itself could not be recognized.
Are you certain that that's the consequence? Are you certain that that's the consequence if there's a violation of, and by the way, maybe it's just the operating agreement. Are you certain that if that restriction exists, and it is as you say it is, that prohibits in any way the transfer and that any purported transfer is void? Is that the relief? Is that the consequence of it? Maybe it is. I'm just curious.
Yes, I believe it is. I believe that if you don't follow the commission's rules on the transfer is void.
Aside from that rule, let's assume we don't conclude or agree that that would have voided the transaction. I don't know that you answered Chief Justice Stenson's question. How then, in your view, was this property or the membership interest held after the transfer?
It's my position that, well, first of all, because the transfer was not authorized by law, the transfer could not have been completed. I can tell you how I know it wasn't held. It was not held as a tenancy by the entireties. And I know that because South Dakota law says this is how you can own property. Now, an LLC member...
That's correct.
Pardon?
Let's assume that's correct, that it wasn't a tenancy by entirety. Then what? Then how is it held?
Well, there's only a couple of other ways it could be held. It could be held as a joint tenancy, or it could be held as tenancy in common, because we can do that with personal property. A membership interest is an intangible piece of personal property. However, they could not have intended to create a joint tenancy. And we know this because Florida statute, and we cited that in the brief, specifically says we don't recognize joint tenancy. They're Florida residents, and that's the statute they're relying on. So they couldn't have intended this to be a joint tenancy. They could not have held it as tenancy by the entireties because tenancy by the entireties has six unities. South Dakota recognizes four. And one of the unities that is required to be in place under their tenancy by the entireties is the unity of marriage. One of the things that the Shimke case tells us, they do a nice analysis of the what they refer to as the various married women's acts, the whole two shall be as one thing. In South Dakota, very forward-thinking, decided, no. We're not saying that the man's wife and the woman's wife, the spouses, it's all one person, usually because the man runs things. Instead, they were saying women have their own separate property. They have their own separate idea. They have their own separate identity. Consequently, we're not having the tenancy by the entireties. So if South Dakota says you can't create a tenancy by the entireties, and we know that we don't have joint tenancy because they don't have the unity of time, what he did was assign his interest. He already had his interest. They did not obtain that interest simultaneously. So they don't have at least one of the critical four unities. Consequently, there is no joint tenancy. So what's left? Tenancy in common. Tenancy in common doesn't guarantee that his interest automatically goes to her. His interest upon his death, and as we'll recall, a couple of weeks before the final sale of the business took place, he died. His interest would have remained at the best. His interest would have been his estate's interest. But again, we can't ignore that the gaming industry is heavily regulated, and the gaming industry gets to say who owns businesses, gambling establishments, and who doesn't. And so we can't ignore that. What we can do is we can say their rules are no transfer without our permission. What happens without their permission? It's not my job, it's not our job to enforce their rules. All we can do is recognize what would be the natural implication. If they say you can't do it, but you do it anyway, do we just shrug our shoulders and say, oh, well, which seems to be kind of the theme of what happened with this case, Or do we say, well, the natural consequences, that's not an appropriate transfer?
So here, Clarence is no longer a party here. Here we're looking at what did Hickox, and I'm going to focus on Hickox, do or not do.
Right.
So with regard to this transfer, and then the later issue of how it affected the charging order, what was the obligation of Hickox? What should Hickox have done under this scenario?
Well, there's a couple of things they could have done. What they should have done, when you look at the language of the charging order, they're supposed to notify the judgment holder of distributions due or to become due. What they could have done and what they should have done.
Well, but the charging order isn't directed at Hickox, is it?
Oh, yes. The charging order is directed at Hickox.
That particular requirement that you just mentioned.
You mean as far as the notice?
Yes.
The smart thing would have been, and I'm going to tie this into the July 2020 agreement that was reached amongst everybody.
Oh, I want to stop you there, though. You say the smart thing. That's a long ways from willful and contemptuous, isn't it? You're saying the smart thing would have been to do this, not willful and contemptuous.
Oh, no, I understand that. I understand that. And I guess I have a separate answer for that if we're getting into that part.
Yeah, well, that's really what I'm interested in.
Okay.
You've got a lot of issues with how do we own this?
Right.
Was there an interest that was properly transferred or not? All those kinds of things. But you've got to show willful and contemptuous, and
sure.
that's a pretty high threshold.
Understood. And I guess to start with, I would indicate that, and again, we set this out in the brief, the standard is not willful and contemptuous. It's willful or contemptuous. And what's interesting is when we look at the definition, we all agree, no one disputes that there was a valid existing order. No one disagrees that there was an ability to comply with the order. No one disagrees, and in fact, the findings with respect to Hickox would bear out, no one disagrees that they didn't follow the order. The question was whether it was willfully not followed or contumaciously not followed. Now, factually, we know that back in 2015, they were trying to make sure that nobody could get a hold of Nick Griffin's interest in his LLC, because there was about to be a judgment. We go to 2020, when an agreement was made to sell the building, and we see in that agreement in July, there was a larger agreement that says, okay, when this thing sells, Tricano wants his interest to go to his trust. And it also says, we recognize his charging orders in effect, and we recognize that Broccoli might have some interest. So Tricano says, I want Hickox. I want I want Hickox to indemnify me. I want everybody to indemnify my trust. Now, he's doing this for himself. He's not doing this as the managing member of Hickox at this point. He's saying, I want to protect myself. At the October 22 hearing, counsel for Tricano pretty much explained to the court, and this is all based on the rest of the facts. And I think it's important that we hear this, and this is located at page 25 of the brief. And so counsel says, so we knew, and I'll say we because I drafted the contracts. That's counsel talking. We knew that there was a possibility that even though the deal was structured so that Mr. Broccoli had absolutely no interest in anything, in any money that we were affecting by the transaction, we knew that despite that, there was a high likelihood, a reasonably high likelihood, that he was going to find some bizarre way to come after Griffin through Tricano. They knew back then that what they were trying to do was make sure that Griffin gets his money and Broccoli doesn't get anything pursuant to a valid existing charging.
Well, what you're describing perhaps is purposeful, intentional if you like, in some ways, but that may not be purposeful or the same sort of willfulness that is used in context of describing noncompliance or defiance of an order. In other words, they may well have done exactly what they said, exactly what's written down. That doesn't mean they willfully disobeyed an order, a charging order.
I understand what you're saying, and of course I respectfully disagree. Especially when we take a look at the facts around what happened during the sale. And again, this is laid out in the brief, but in effect, what happens during the sale is Mr. Takano signs off all the documents and then walks away, covers his ears, and says, I don't know anything about anything else, knowing that the purported final owner of the rest of the member share, Kimberly Griffin, is in Florida, and tasks her attorney to transfer that money, not from the closing agent to put it in Hickok's account, but to send it to Florida. That money is gone. And he knew, Tricano knew that was going to happen, and Hickox knew it was going to happen, but they did it anyway, knowing that that was what was going to happen. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dill. You may proceed, Mr. Plummer, with your argument.
Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, may it please the Court. I'm Richard Plummer from Spearview, South Dakota. I represent Mike Trucano and the Mike Trucano Living Trust. I drew the short straw, and so I was advised I have to condense my entire package of arguments into 4 minutes, so I will be brief. But I will ask you to focus on one date, and that is December 29 of 2020. That is the date that the Hickox Casino and Hotel was sold. That is also the date by which Hickox redeemed the interest of Mr. Trucano's trust. Prior to December 29, 2020, Mr. Trucano was involved in the conduct and management of the business, and the record is very clear. There was no distribution of any kind implicated by the charging order during that tenure. On December 29, 2020, Mr. Trucano became disassociated with Hickox because he transferred his ownership interest in the membership. He resigned any position or duties he had with Hickox and severed that business relationship. By statute, the disassociation terminates the right of any member to participate in the conduct and management of the business after that disassociation occurs. So take a look at what happens after Mr. Trucano is disassociated and is not participating in the conduct or the affairs of the business. The money is that would have been entitled to be transferred to Hickox was transferred to a new Florida bank account. Counsel for Hickox arranged with the closing agent to make that transfer post-closing, inconsistent with the instructions that the agent had agreed to prior to closing. And in January of the following year, distributions of approximately $1.1 million were made from the Florida bank account to Mrs. Griffin. Mr. Trucano was not involved. The affidavit of both the closing agent and Hickox and Mrs. Griffin's attorney acknowledged that those decisions were made after Mr. Trucano disassociated with Hickox and left the closing, that he had no knowledge, participation, involvement in any of those transactions occurring after December 29. Trial court so found, we ask you to affirm as it relates to Trucano. Thank you.
Mr. Dill, he argued that your client got out of the LLC, plugged his ears and walked away, essentially arguing some sort of, I guess, bad faith. But it's, as you're pointing out, would be bad faith prior to the actual distribution. Would you like to respond to that sort of typification?
Just very briefly. To the extent that he, that Mr. Dill suggests or implies that by building in an indemnification agreement into a business transaction, that hardly counts bad faith. And the mere fact that we're here shows the legitimacy of the concern that Mr. Trucano had that Mr. Broccoli and Mrs. Broccoli would try to find some means of coming after him individually. So it's simply a question that Mr. Trucano didn't violate the charging order. We don't even have to get to the willful contumacious portion of that. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kwan.
Thank you.
Juarez, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Cesar Juarez, and together with my partner, Aaron Galloway, we represent Hickox Hotel & Suites, LLC, formerly known as NMD Venture, LLC, in this matter. Although there is multiple issues raised by appellants in their briefs, there is really just one issue before the court today, namely that the trial court did not err when it found that Hickox did not violate the charging order and therefore was not in contempt. As Mr. Dill correctly outlined, there is four elements to contempt: existence of an order, knowledge of that order, ability to comply with that order, and willful and contumacious disobedience of that order. Three of those four elements are not disputed. They were not disputed at the trial court level. They're not disputed now. Only the fourth element is disputed. And as some of you justices pointed out, the timeline of when the transfer occurred in this case is very important in this case. March 30th of 2015 is when then-member of the LLC, Clarence Griffin, transferred half of all of his interest in this LLC from himself individually to himself and his wife, Kimberly Griffin, as tenants by the entireties under Florida law. They were both residents of Florida when this transfer happened. They both signed this document in Florida. It was witnessed by a notary public in Florida. On this record, there could be no dispute that this document was executed in Florida under Florida law. That happened March 30th of 2015. The first charging order in this case was not issued until December of 2016. The charging order we are here today to talk about was not issued until February 3rd of 2017, almost 2 years later. Bringing me back to the contempt analysis, as I stated, the first three elements are undisputed. The fourth element, on the record the trial court had before it, there's absolutely no evidence that planning that occurred almost 2 years before this charging order existed somehow constitutes evidence of willful disobedience, contumacious disobedience with an order that did not even exist at that point.
Mr. Juarez, our charging document or our charging order statutes seems to me contemplate a lien upon the distributional interest, more so inclusion of the membership interest itself. Would you agree with that?
No, yes, Your Honor. The charging order is a lien on the distributional interest.
But yes. Not the membership itself. In other words, you can't use a charging order, in this state anyway, to foreclose upon a member's membership interest in that equity.
That's absolutely right.
If that's right, does it matter, or what effect, if any, is there that a transfer was authorized by an operating agreement or the Gaming Commission or whomever?
In this particular case, Your Honor, the first of all, that argument relating the Gaming Commission, it wasn't before the trial court. It was raised on the motion to reconsider after the trial court had ruled. So it's not, it's our position that it is not an issue before this court that was properly preserved. But even if it was, the assignment document has a blanket waiver of any statutory or provisions of the operating agreement that all members at that time signed off on. And so as your Honor asked Mr. Dill during his time, even if it was, then is not the appellants who have the ability to challenge that transfer. And in fact, appellant counsel for the appellants admitted over and over again at the December 15, 2021 hearing that Ms. Griffin is the sole member of the LLC. And if Your Honors go back through that transcript, the trial judge was very, very careful in confirming over and over again that for purposes of the contempt analysis, appellants agreed Ms. Griffin was the sole member of that LLC. So if we go back to why we're here today, we're here today because there was a charging order. The charging order requires that any interest that will be paid, any distribution that would were to be paid to Clarence Griffin be paid to the appellants directly. The record is clear, no such distribution ever happened after the charging order went into effect on February 3rd, 2017. There is no record that any such distribution ever happened, and to the extent appellants now argue that the distribution later to Ms. Griffin is somehow a violation, that is simply not supported by the record because she is not named in the charging order, and appellants agreed that she was the sole member of the LLC at that point. So there, any distributions made to her are not and cannot be a violation of the charging order. And for all those reasons, we believe that the trial court was correct in finding that Hickox did not violate that charging order and was not in contempt. And briefly, with the time that I have left, I want to briefly touch on a couple of the other arguments that Mr. Dill has made before the court today. I want to clarify a couple of things. First of all, Mr. Dill said that there is no dispute there has been a violation of the charging order. I suspect that was he simply misspoke because there is a dispute. Hickox has not violated the charging order. The dispute is whether the trial court erred when it found that there has been no violation. And as we've been discussing, the trial court did not err. The trial court applied the law as existing in South Dakota today, applied the facts, and found that there has not been a violation of the charging order. Now, briefly, with this argument that the transfer was somehow invalid, or we've heard it called today as a purported transfer, again, Your Honors, that argument was because counsel admitted at the December 15, 2021 hearing that Kimberly Griffin was the sole member of the LLC. And for her to be the sole member of the LLC, the transfer had to predate that. And in fact, I don't want to quote counsel too much, but at one particular time, counsel said at that hearing, quote, what happened was Kim Griffin, as the sole member, made a distribution, end quote. After that exchange.
Pardon me for interrupting. Would your analysis change if, and unfortunately Mr. Griffin passed away, if that weren't the case, would your analysis be altered, perhaps?
No, Your Honor. The analysis would remain the same. The only distinction would be that his distributional interest, which is affected by the charging order, would remain intact. Whether or not is the membership interest is owned by him individually by himself or by him with his wife as tenants by the entireties, had he survived this closing, his distributional interest will still remain attached to that lien. And so if there was a distribution to be made to Mr. Griffin at that point, the charging order was in effect, it would have gone to the appellants. The unfortunate circumstance we find ourselves in is that Mr. Griffin passed away 2 weeks before the closing.
my question wasn't very good. The analysis remains the same as you say. The outcome would be different.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, the outcome would be different, but the analysis remains the same. And again, there's never been a dispute that this charging order is effective, that it exists, and that Hickox has been complying with it and continues to comply to it today. Now, there was a couple other things that arguments that Mr. Dill raised that I want to briefly touch on. As to this issue of tenants by the entireties, we understand the Shimke decision. We understand Shimke and this court in Shimke in 1973 stated, as between two South Dakota residents who are owning real property, tenancies by the entireties cannot be created in this state. That case is still good law today. We're not saying it isn't. But it is very different because in this case, we are talking about Florida residents who own intangible personal property in South Dakota. And our legislature has recognized in acts that were passed after Shimke that there may be situations in which a non-resident of this state holds property by tenancies by the entireties under their home state, and that South Dakota will recognize such tenancies by the entireties in South Dakota. Now, the statutes I'm referring to, they're not directly applicable to this case, so I don't want to be misconstrued as saying that they are, but it is the UNIFOR, the Fraudulent Transferred Act, which was passed in 1987 after Shimke. Also the Uniform Partnership Act, which was passed in 2001 after Shimke, and the Uniform Probate Code, which was passed in 95, also after Shimke. Each of those statutes recognizes that tenancies by the entireties created in another state may be recognized in South Dakota for intangible personal property. And so for all those reasons, Shimke is distinguishable and is not applicable to the particular issue before the court today. And for all these reasons, Your Honors, we ask that this court affirm the trial court in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Mr. Dill, you may proceed with your rebuttal argument.
Thank you. Just a couple of points to touch on. Counsel for Hickox indicates with respect to his support for Tennessee by the entireties that the documents were signed in Florida, that they were residents of Florida at the same time. And I would posit to the court that while not strictly analogous, that's not unlike saying two Florida residents could buy a piece of real property in South Dakota and deed it to themselves as Tennessee by the entireties. We know that that's not a correct statement of the law. The statute 43-2-9 refers to taking, holding, and disposing of real or personal property within this state. Contrary to what Mr. Juarez indicates, Shimke should not be used to modify the language that says Tennessee by the entireties does not exist, because statute clearly involves owning real or personal property.
I don't want to put a constitutional dimension to this. I don't think it's really in there, so forgive me for putting it out there. But on some level, wouldn't South Dakota be obligated to accord full faith and credit to the statutory method by which citizens of another state hold property, personal property, even personal property in this state? And I have a question mark at the end. I'm not saying that they do. I'm just saying, is that possible? Or
It's possible. And I can foresee a circumstance where either one of us owns a piece of property in Florida pursuant to tenancy by the entireties. I can own a tenancy by the entireties interest in a state that recognizes them, but it's subject to that state's regulation. You can't create a tenancy by the entireties in South Dakota. Now, that doesn't mean that a tenancy by the entireties attached to somebody, a partnership could be formed in South Dakota with multiple partners throughout the country, and one of those partners could have a tenancy by the entirety's ownership interest as part of that partnership, but that does not create that ownership interest in South Dakota as a tenancy by the entirety's. So they can exist. We don't cover our eyes and say those words don't exist. Of course, they exist in other states, but that's not the same thing as saying you can create one in South Dakota. And that's what they did here. This LLC started and is cited in South Dakota. And the question as to, so what statute or what law do we follow? We cited the J.P. Morgan case. It was a Colorado case from a couple of years back that indicated just that sort of thing. When you have multiple jurisdictions involved, which state do you follow? And the import of J.P. Morgan was, it makes most sense, especially when you've got multiple jurisdictions. It makes most sense to follow the domicile of the LLC. In this case, it was created in South Dakota. I believe the language they used is in referencing multiple jurisdictions. I think they cited three different ones, where ultimately, so whose law applies? The J.P. Morgan case indicated it sort of militates toward following where the LLC was created because it helps to avoid confusion. And all we want to do is avoid confusion. And really, in this case, what we want to do is enforce the one remedy that we have that's been taken away from us with respect to the actions that were put in place well beyond just good estate planning, well beyond just good business planning, but knowingly in advance making sure that this charging order cannot be enforced because there's nothing there to enforce it. And better to shrug our shoulders and say, oh, well, what are you going to do, is kind of what they're counting on. What we're asking the court to do is to say, well, here's what we'll do. We'll enforce the thing. The facts are more than sufficient when reviewing all of the facts to show that the failure to follow the charging order was willful. I've never liked the definition of contumacious because it's so amorphous. It's one of those, I know it when I see it. But I believe that their actions were certainly willful. And that left the Broccolis with more than $1.3 million of money that just been spirited away that Hickox and Tricano would have us believe, well, you'll never get it back now. So that's ultimately what we're looking for. Hickox's position hinges entirely on the tenancy by the entirety's analysis, which we believe is gone. Their argument, they somehow seem to indicate they can waive the right, the Gaming Commission's rules to say, yeah, we can transfer this, we can waive all of that. I see my time is up, and I want to thank you again for the opportunity to appear today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dill. I want to thank counsel for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.